HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We are burning down the house this Wednesday, 6th of October, 2010. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. This episode is brought to you by TechServe, number one source for everything related to the Apple computer, iPad, iPod, widescreen monitors, pro audio. TechServe is a good sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and is devoted to sustainable life. They have an e-waste event coming up. I believe it's this weekend. They're located on West 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. And you can read more about what they have to offer at www.tekserve.com. This evening, we're going to talk about the design of consumer products, how they make our life better, how industrial designers are making the things that we need in our life more affordable in this Great Depression version 2.0 when everybody's broke. Joining me in studio this evening is Rich Thrush. You're now design director. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
At
Kaz Incorporated?
So yeah.
That's not many people know that, but that's basically the company that does the design for the Vicks products, the hard goods, the Honeywell products, the ones you would buy in the store, and also a few Braun products, so some Braun home medical products and things like that.
How very cool. Well, congratulations on your promotion. Rich has been on before with us last year, and I'm happy to have him back. We find ourselves in an interesting juncture in history. The mad world of just simply consuming and buying, and the huge wave of consumer goods that came out of the Far East over the last 15 years made us feel rich because we could buy the latest electronic gadget for practically nothing because the goods coming out of, well, first it was Indonesia, then Malaysia, and then China.
But that's really like a perception, right? Because, sorry, losing the mic a little bit here. But that's perception, right? Because weren't we doing that a long time ago after World War II? There was a huge flood of goods, maybe not from the Far East.
We had Japanese stuff.
Right, right. So, I mean, that's the latest wave, but, you know, we started off with things we picked up outside the cave, and we've had waves of breakthroughs and so forth, and that's the latest wave. Is it good? Is it bad? That's tough to
say.
Or
is it just is? Yeah. But it seems to me, now, you know, I'm an architect. I'm not an industrial designer. I'm not in the world of consumer goods, as are you, that the value-added aspect of the stuff that they sell, for example, at Target, where there is an attempt to provide goods that have, you know, I'll put this in quotes, good design, that if you're going to buy something, you would want for it to be durable and for it to be beautiful. I suppose one of the primary examples of this is the line of Dyson vacuums, which are pretty good looking. They say that they work better than other people's vacuums, and they cost so much that you're not about to throw it out.
Yeah, and I'm not
sure.
What
do you think about that?
Well, first off, I mean, that's for a certain class of people. I mean, if you're going to spend $200 on a vacuum, I haven't.
I think they're more in the 500s.
Yeah, they start up there, and I think they've dropped in, you know, even the low price point. But I know they have a fan that's like $250 or something,
that's the fan with no moving parts.
Yeah,
which is interesting physics, but.
Yeah, but I mean, if for the people that I've dealt with and that I've designed for, which are Target people or Walmart people, that's a hell of a stretch. Like to
be able to afford that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really especially in the New York, we're both from the New York area, right? But people here have more disposable income, so maybe we have a false sense of those people. But you get out to the middle of the country, you get out to Ohio, you get out to Arkansas.
Or Indiana.
Or Indiana, whatever.
We'll talk about Indiana later, friends.
But those people are, they don't have access to...
No, they don't have. They don't have any
products.
Money.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's true.
So maybe Target would be even the regular goods at Target are kind of a step up for them because they're stretching up to Target even from Walmart or
Gee,
the local store.
How interesting! Target as an aspirational shopping experience.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a little break and Nat, if you give me track two.
A song of great social and political import. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing $4 is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town?
Thank you, Janis. That was, of course, the legendary Janis Joplin, who died 40 years ago this week. First it was Jimi Hendrix, then it was Janis.
Did she have a Mercedes?
I reckon that when she died, she probably could have had a Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah, I would like to know the test, though. I mean, if she could have, I wonder if she did.
I don't know. We'll have to research that. Or maybe Dan can research whether Janis ever owned a Mercedes. But that's that's an aspirational consumer attitude, which obviously she's mocking in that song. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in architecture, there's a persistent theme comes around every, 50 years or so, in which we architects believe that good design will actually improve the life of the people using our buildings. To what extent do people who are industrial designers, product designers, think that they're improving the everyday life?
Well, I mean, we'd like to think we do it every day, right? And at least everything we touch, right? The alternative is no design, or design by maybe an engineer at the factory in China or Taiwan or Vietnam, and some of the stuff happens organically too, right? It could be someone, a design they had from the 1970s, and they changed something and put new knobs on it, and it takes on a new life. But so really, we're with many of the things we're working with, and we work with a range of things, but they range from that basic level of we touch it and do what we can with it, or nobody does. Doesn't mean that we're going to sell it and we would put the brand names that we deal with on that product. But, I do feel, I mean, that's one of the things that keeps me going to work every day, aside from the paycheck, that we're doing something good. And believe me, I have no illusion that we're changing the world or anything like that. Otherwise, I would probably be in the Peace Corps. Or maybe
a piece at a time.
Yeah.
Is there any, from your observation, at a corporate level, in and among the big producers, like Braun, is there a sense of democratization? I know that on the flip side, there are many, many designers. Case in point, when Tata Motors bought the Jaguar line of cars, they've decided to reposition it as a super elite product. So we know that there are producers who are looking at making their goods.
That's an altruistic way to look at
it. But what about the other side where, you know, there would be a sense that there should be good design for everyone?
I think in certainly in our discipline, it comes up from, if you want to talk about the powers that be that run these businesses, maybe not. You know, they're interested in what that brand supports. And in some cases, in with Braun, part of it is design. I mean, that's a core part of the Braun
selling.
Brand.
Yeah, sure.
And that's and they think they would, I'm sure they'd love to sell it to everyone, from the high-end consumers to the mid-range consumers to just the lower-end consumers that can stretch up to it.
Right. And then at a certain point, occasionally, one does encounter a really good knockoff.
Right.
I mean, I found a $10 travel clock radio that is as close to a total ripoff of the Dieter Rams Braun travel
Dietrich
alarm.
Lubs. Yeah, yeah. Dietrich Lubs, I think, did it when under the Dieter Rams era. Braun, yeah.
Without being out and out plagiarism. Yeah.
Well,
and it makes me happy because the Braun clocks are kind of pricey.
Well, have you been to this museum? There's a museum in Germany, the Plagiarius Museum.
No, I haven't.
The best product knockoffs, and it's really? On my list.
Plagiarius, how excellent! What a great name.
Yeah, it's really. I mean, it's tough. It's tough not to. It's an homage to the original people who produced the product, but also it's really. I mean, it's painful if you're that corporation and someone comes after you and produces knockoffs. And there are knockoffs at all levels. I think the really strange knockoffs are the ones that mock the design but don't bring the benefits. So they may look like the Braun Dietrich Lubs clock that you're talking about, that alarm clock, but but maybe it doesn't work as well for whatever reason. And that's really. That's strange to me because I feel like it's taken on a life of its own. It's like the design was it's there for a purpose. I mean,
sure.
That brand is focused on usability
and working. A knockoff is not going to work quite as well because it's going to have some sort of slightly luminescent paint on the hands instead of tritium capsules that will glow
radioactive.
in the dark for the next 200 years.
And that's expensive. I'm wondering, you don't have the real one, so I
used to.
Yeah, okay.
It broke.
So you have
a, I have
can
a knockoff.
You sense a difference between the two? Or?
Oh, sure. The quality of the product is I mean, it's scrofulous casting, whereas the Braun is as precise as a razor blade.
Right, right.
And by the way, I think Gillette makes a lot of that stuff because of their really high precision manufacturing capabilities. It came out of razor blade.
So Gillette is currently owned by Procter & Gamble.
Right.
And so is Braun. So they, you know, Braun is their own entity, but they, I don't know what the ownership exactly entails. But so they are, in a way, sister companies. I don't know.
Procter & Gamble is the world's largest company of that kind. There is a bit of democratization there.
Yeah, and I think they impose that probably on, you know, I don't know too much about it. But
on all their
brand
lines,
you know, you would imagine they're the parent company, and there's a little bit of that culture that ekes into everybody that they deal with.
Let's take another little break. Nat, if I could have track 3, please.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was a-sounding. This land was made for you and me. There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. Sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust cloud rolling. A voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. Is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw...
That was, of course, Woody Guthrie singing his own wonderful, almost national anthem, This Land Is Your Land, here on Heritage Radio Network. This is Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and my guest is Rich Thrush, industrial designer. And I wanted to play that because there's a spirit. There was a spirit. There is a spirit from time to time that this land is our land. And we designers, and it goes around in a cycle, often are possessed with a liberalizing and eminently democratic urge to have good design for everyone.
I wonder if you find that same thing in architecture. Do you find that there's a range there between the really low cost stuff that you can bring something good to someone at a low cost level?
Well, we try. It's not common. Over the last boom, I have observed that there was just so much of this look at me stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And which brings me around to wanting to talk about this perfect convergence that happened about 40 years ago now. In the work of Massimo Vignelli, who was a wonderful graphic designer. He's one of the proponents of the universally found, ubiquitous typeface Helvetica, although he did not design it, I do not think.
Yeah, but he did use it a lot.
But then he did design consumer items like the... Once upon a time was fairly ubiquitous among young architects, the Heller melamine cup and dinnerware, which was good design. It was simple because it's plastic. It's not too expensive. It's you can't break it.
Still runs today.
And it's still in production. And it's a line of product that does not scream, look at me, look at me. It's just there. And it's got its own simple beauty. It's got a graphic sort of line to it. And so the Heller mug is an example of trying to bring good design to the masses in an inexpensive medium. Yeah, but I don't see that these days. I don't see that revolutionary zeal to promote what could be a fairly anonymous product.
Well, I think products today have really gotten more complex than they have. So the baseline for a radio or whatever it is a lot higher. There's more complexity. There's more, you know, a mug was a mug back in 1967,
Right, exactly.
So those things, the mugs today, there are still amazing designed mugs that are out there available at Target.
Sure.
For $110 if you have the money to spend on it. But
the MoMA gift shop will sell you a lot of really expensive stuff. I mean, if you want to buy an Alvar Aalto vase, it's gonna set you back, even though it's just crystal. I mean,
it's beautiful. Right. I mean, I'm not gonna dispute that it's worth the money, but maybe I don't have that money this second. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Even as design professionals, we don't fall into that extremely high level where we can make a purchase like that on a whim.
You only get that as a wedding present.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
If you ask for it. But one of the things that was really grand about that period of time, and it wasn't just the Vanelli studio, there was also the Memphis group and Ettore Sottsass. They were doing amazing things, and there was a scalability to that design thinking that you could do a little
And you really come from the architecture side, so you key into that too.
Well,
I mean,
scale is very important to us. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mention just in passing that this coming Sunday is 10-10-10, 10th of October, 2010. And it is the International Powers of 10 Day, in which we celebrate looking at the world in different scales. If you have not seen the legendary Eames Studio movie, The Powers of 10, you really owe it to yourself to go look it up on the internet and have a watch, because it's all about the universe and different ways of looking at ourselves as creatures in the world, our planet, in our galaxy, and then back down into the molecular level. And so this coming Sunday.
I saw that at school. Where did you first see that? Do you remember?
Yes.
We saw that, well, I think, on film. On real film.
I'm dating myself here, but I don't mind, you know. Everybody knows I'm as old as Methuselah here at Heritage Radio Network. Charles Eames came to address the New York State Society of Architects in 1975, in the spring of 75, mm-hmm. at the ballroom at the Old Commodore Hotel, which is now the Hyatt Regency next to Grand Central. And we were required for our professional practice course to attend. And I was so happy to meet Eames. And I shook his hand, and there he was. He had, you know, with the crew cut and the bow tie and skinny lapels that were 15 years out of date. And I had all these questions. And he said, just wait. I'll answer all of your questions in my speech. And he did. He found me out in the audience, and he kept eye contact, and he was talking to me. And he rolled a cut from Powers of 10 that they were working on at that time. He played 3 or 4 minutes of it, and he played a couple other of, or showed, actually screened, a couple of his other short movies that he'd done for IBM.
Yeah, and somehow my science school, my high school science teacher got a hold of that at the time and played it for us, and it was, I mean, it was really out of character, right? Because we normally get the
No, but it, but
normal
it,
droll, and then you,
but
we
then you
had
get
this
a little movie.
Movie,
yeah,
that was just like no lead up, nothing. You know, this is.
But did it?
I
mean, but did it expand your mind? I mean, did it really?
It
just,
was as much as I was paying attention. For as much as I was paying attention at that time, it did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I showed it to my structural engineering students when I taught structures this spring, mm-hmm. the local architectural technology program at Norwalk Community College. And it really helped them because I discovered as I began the class that half of my class had not taken physics yet. Mm. And practically none of them had had any algebra for years and years. And when you're doing structural calculations, in many cases, you're dealing with very high scientific exponential values. The coefficient of expansion of steel, for example, degree of heat per unit of length is something like 6.21 times 10 to the 23rd. -23rd or something like some vast
you're
number.
Talking about Avogadro's number 6.023
something
times
like
10
that.
To the 23rd.
You know, there are very
yeah.
interesting convergences between the molecular number and other things which are kind of interesting if you're a if you like to play with numbers. And so 10-10-10 day is all about the numerology of things,
and, it,
and
you
it's
know,
kind
it's,
of an interesting it, event.
It's really beautiful that film, how it switches. You recognize that things go from grainy to big, and then grainy again. It's almost like levels. It's
levels of resolution.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's really,
and that's one
incredible.
Of the things that really excites me about a well-made consumer object, you know, like a Braun project product, is the high precision that we have available to us in manufacturing these days.
Yeah, I used to do.
I mean, except for your Ducati, which I guess looks good.
Did
but
you check that out? How did you know that?
You told us about that last
time. Oh,
okay,
all right.
You spent a lot of time pushing it. It looks.
I'm
good,
trying
but
to. I'm their biggest spokesperson, apparently. Eh?
I don't know. Speak for yourself. Is that why you were delayed getting here?
Well, it helped.
But, you know, everything that we produce does not have to be pristine. I mean, case in point, our good friend, Professor Toby Cumberbatch at the Cooper Union, who's an engineering professor, has a joint studio where engineers and or future engineers and future artisans, future architects, are working to study ways of making structure out of garbage. And as a matter of fact, if any listeners out there know of a patch of ground, a disused lot, a parking lot that could be used for just one Saturday, the students are looking for a site to build this year's garbage house. And if you do, send me an email, info@heritageradionetwork.com. Put the title of your email, Garbage House, because we'd like to find a site for the students to be able to work on that. Their main concept is to use discarded water bottles, which are wonderful because they're very beautifully crafted, you know, and they trap air, so they're insulated.
Last for nearly ever. Yeah.
And if temporary housing could be made out of trash, what an interesting thing that would be, because we've got trash everywhere.
Yeah, no shortage.
But back to the era of Vignelli and of other designers of that sensibility, there's the potential for democratization of good design. There's also the potential for a little bit of delight in your everyday life if something that you're going to need to have can also be beautiful.
I would love for that to be the case. That unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, it's not really our primary goal. You know, usually when we're doing a product, I think we're thinking more about usability and having a great product that that works rather than beauty.
Well, that
we want
that
it to be beautiful
that,
too.
But that could be beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean,
it can. Yeah, that's a different way of looking at beauty. I mean, I think just pure beauty for beauty's sake is really in most of the stuff that I've been involved with. And I've worked for Motorola for some time. I've worked on toys at Hasbro, and that's really secondary. You know, that comes out of hopefully from the function and the use of it. And it's amazing when you look at things at that level, and it happens in architecture too, I'm sure, right? Where if you're thinking about function first, and but not limiting yourself to just function.
I think
because
the overlay
best functional product
I think
isn't
the overlay
always good
here,
either.
Or the commonality between architecture and product design would be that. Of course, this could be all cultural scrim we're seeing things through. If you understand the function of the design product, whether it's a building or a toaster, without having to have wayfinding tell you, without having to read the labels on the buttons of your stereo, one of my favorite objects that I've cherished ever since I bought it is a stereo amplifier that was produced by NAD. And the power button is square and green. And it's very clearly green. Go. Okay. And the volume knob, it's not a slider, it's not digital, is big. It's like, there's the volume. Got that. Then the rest of the buttons are things that you have to read. Which input is it or something else. But the two main things that you're operating almost all the time are clearly understandable for what they are. The power and the volume.
Right. And I think we talk about
that's
this more than you could possibly imagine. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising to spend half the morning talking about the hierarchy of what you need. Of what you need, right? And just writing it out on, we have whiteboards or pieces of paper or whatever. I mean, and that's really, it's not even what I would call classically designing. That's before we even touch pen to paper. It's really just talking about what people need out of this thing. And We watch people too. I mean, that's becoming a big part of design, at least design. I'm sure. It filters into all design aspects.
In architecture, it's called results-based design.
Mm-hmm.
How are people using the spaces that we have created?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I think most design firms or design organizations that you'll deal with today will be doing this, right? They'll go into people's homes and they'll watch them use their camera and see how the camera works and try to understand how they wish the camera could work. And maybe they don't answer the consumer's question directly. So maybe they don't, if the consumer asks for something direct, maybe that's not what actually happens in design. But they respond to that. And somehow that, if you have that background, that'll help you get to something that's a little bit better at the end.
Yeah, that's
hopefully.
Good. Well, I would think that if you're designing medical apparatuses, you want to make sure that it's easy to use properly and hard to use improperly so that in a trauma situation, someone doesn't hit the kill button when they should have hit the live button.
Yeah, trauma or, I guess probably more appropriate to what we do would be, the mother and child, you know. Most of the products we make are home medical products.
So oh, that's great, yeah.
Like a thermometer, right? So you see mom and she's, you know how you are when you're, I don't know if you have, if your listeners have, how many of them have children, right?
Some of them do.
Probably a few do. But when your child is sick, it's frightening. And
you want it to work, and you want it to work simply.
You want it to work simply. You want it to work now. You want it to tell you what to do. If it could talk to you and say, call the doctor or take your child to the hospital.
What a great idea.
Most mothers would
A thermometer that dials the doctor's office.
You might get a lot of more calls.
Yeah. Well, that's very cool. Well, let's have a little more music. Let's have track 5, please.
You just stood there.
Yeah. Lucinda Williams with Positively 4th Street. A prime example of what it's like to struggle with a product where they didn't, you know, stand in your shoes, and what's how it's like to, you know, to be you, to work with that product. Well, telling you. Here at Heritage Radio Network, brought to you by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. iPads, iPods, iPhones, widescreen monitors, pro audio on West 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. Joining me this evening is Rich Thrush, industrial designer. You were talking during the break about what it is that you do in your company at CAS.
Sure.
Doesn't it feel positively 4th Street when you struggle with a product that's been so poorly designed?
Well, like I said, I mean, and you probably, it's the same thing with architecture, right? I mean, you are, as a designer, selling something as well, right? You're selling it internally, you're selling it to marketing people, you're selling it to engineers. So if you can't enfranchise the people in your own organization about what's good and what's bad, then really, how are you going to enfranchise the person who would buy the product?
Well, that's right. To a certain degree, I mean, this is a word that gets thrown around a lot. There's got to be transparency of communication.
Right. Yeah, I guess there probably are product designers, and I don't know a whole heck of a lot of them, that are like brand name designers that do the work and are able to, you know, hand it down from high on the mountain. But how often does that happen? I would say rarer than not.
Like Philippe Starck?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's really setting the direction, right, for his team, probably, and his team is doing the work. And
Sketching all the time, handing off crazy stuff, and
they
make it happen.
Right.
Which doesn't mean that they're good. I mean, for example, his ghost chair is not a particularly good chair. It's not comfortable. It's clear plastic.
It's a statement.
It's a statement.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that looks wonderful at the Hudson Hotel, for example.
Right,
that,
right. But I don't have one in my kitchen.
No, and I wouldn't have one in my house.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. On the other hand, I have a Niels Different Freedom Chair, one of the world's best ergonomic desk chairs. And it's all articulated, and it's very comfortable. Rather expensive, but it was good value.
It's good to splurge. Yeah, you deserve it.
It also helped that when you're an architect and you're buying it for your own use, they give you a triple net discount. So a $1,300 chair only cost me like $400.
Yeah, I like it.
But you have to ask. You have to always ask, what's the trade price?
Okay.
Those are the key
words. Yeah.
Yeah, you go into any sort of... you don't know this? For furnishings, you always ask, what's the trade price?
Right.
Very quiet.
And your card
is... And you present your card.
Yeah, okay. That's the key.
Yeah. What's the trade price?
It's not that... With product design, usually you can trade. Actually physically trade a product for a product.
Well, that's kind of cool.
You get samples. And
that's great. Twelve minutes.
Time check.
Yeah. There is something that I do have to mention. Because it's important to me. My youngest sister, Constance Ann Cash, who despite her country western name, is this very urban architect's dear youngest sister, is unfortunately lost her struggle against cancer. She has been the most cheerful and brave woman for the last 9 years. Every day she was just happy to have another day. So a theme that I'm wishing to convey this evening is, how do we make life better? Some of us will design a beautiful object that people will find wonderful to have in their house. Some of us will design a wonderful structure that will stand for generations and be admired and used. Some others will write lofty, wonderful words. Connie did none of these. She simply lived a decent life and was a good mother and a good friend. And she is now on her deathbed in Indiana. And we're hoping that she can go quietly. But there's this beautiful little meditation from Hamlet's soliloquy that I want to recite in her honor. To die, to sleep, no more. And by asleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished, to die, to sleep. To sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, that's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. May you have sweet eternal dreams, dear sister. You deserve it. You know, we should continue our conversation about design again soon, Rich. This has been Rich Thrush from Dez. This has been Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and we've been sponsored by TechServe. We'll speak with you again. If you could roll track 8, that would be fine, Nat. Thank you.
St. James Infirmary, saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table, so cold, so sweet, so fair. Let her go, let her go. God bless her. Wherever she may be.